Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Joining me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast are two journalists who publish at alternet.org, part of the Gray Zone Project. Max Blumenthal has been a guest with us several times before. He's the author of Goliath and The 51-Day War. Also with us is his colleague Rob Bryan, and they published several articles during the month of May that I want to detail for you on this program today. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us. And Rob Bryan, let me start with you. Your byline appears on this lengthy story that explains the role of Shmuley Boteish, or Botek. He is the right-wing rabbi and quite a hustling guy who has managed to insert himself at a choke point between Donald Trump and big money that supports Zionist causes. Give us a quick sketch of Shmuley and how he has managed to put himself in this position.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ground to cover because he started out in Chabad, which is this ultra-religious Hasidic sect. He was sent by Rabbi Schneerson, who a lot of people in that movement consider to be the Messiah, as an emissary to Oxford, where he started this thing called the L'Chaim Society and befriended Cory Booker, who was a student there.
Now a United States senator from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And that charity ended up being shut down for fraud because he ran it very similar to the way he runs his current charity, the Jewish Values Network, which is to say he pays himself upward of $200,000 a year, you know, sometimes about a third of the revenue, and basically gets these these philanthropists, these people like Sheldon Adelson or Steinhardt, Michael Steinhardt, to contribute huge sums of money to this charity that doesn't really do much of anything. And then, you know, along the way, he's been an author of these kind of self-help type books. He's been a frequent guest on Oprah. He had his own reality show. So he's kind of been all over the place. But yeah, right now he's sort of cozying up to Trump.
And I first caught an article that he wrote slamming Max Blumenthal back in late February that appeared in The Observer, which is a New York-based Jewish-oriented newspaper that is run by Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So explain a little bit about how Shmuley has used The Observer and the connection with Kushner to get closer to Donald Trump.
Well, you know, The Observer wasn't a traditionally Jewish newspaper or anything. It was really sort of just a newspaper that covered New York high society. It ended up being bought by Jared Kushner, who is the son of Charles Kushner, who was a real estate magnate, not unlike Donald Trump in certain respects, who actually went to jail on campaign finance and bribery charges, I believe. You know, at one point there was this whole sordid story where Charles Kushner was filming his brother-in-law having sex with a prostitute and blackmailing people, and that's a whole other thing that kind of got cut from the story. But basically, Jared Kushner, the son, is friends with this guy Ken Kersen, who he brought on as editor-in-chief. Ken Kersen was involved with something called Jamestown Associates, which, you know, took out this big ad against Max, calling him and his father Hillary's anti-Israel advisors, and has also been behind a few ads, full-page ads, that Shmuley has taken out in the New York Times, basically promoting, you know, whatever agenda he has at that moment. At one point, he, you know, was accusing Samantha Powers of enabling genocide. He, you know, said that Hamas engages in child sacrifice or, you know, funded this this full-page ad where Elie Wiesel supposedly wrote that. So, yeah, he's basically used both the ads in the New York Times, which, again, are through Jamestown Associates, the former employer of Ken Kersen, mm-hmm. and the Observer, which Ken Kersen now runs and is owned by Trump's son-in-law, Kushner, as a platform for his views. So I realize it's a little bit, you know, convoluted. It's
that's an excellent thumbnail of more than a 20-page article that you wrote.
Yeah.
And Max Blumenthal is traveling and is on a mobile phone right now, so he'll join us intermittently. Max, I want to ask you directly about the Schmuley ad from the World Values Network that appeared in the New York Times on March 19th, which describes you as a fanatical Israel hater, an anti-Zionist, and links you to your father, Sidney Blumenthal, by saying that you're a rotten apple who didn't fall far from the tree. Is this the first time you've been smeared by Schmuley?
Well, I mean, just to straighten a few things out, I am an anti-Zionist just because I'm an anti-racist. And this is not the first time I was smeared by Schmuley. The most absurd claim in this full-page ad, which probably cost $104,000, was that I was one of Hillary Clinton's secret Middle East advisors. I met Hillary Clinton once when I was 16 for about 5 minutes, and that's the extent of my contact with her. However, some of the emails that were FOIA'd from Hillary Clinton's time at the State Department showed that my father had sent some of my reporting from Israel, Palestine, to her, and she made some kind of banal praise of it. There's really no evidence that it had any influence on her. If anything, the millions of pro-Israel donors like Haim Saban have had a much bigger influence. But what this really was, this ad, which was created, as Rob explained, by Jamestown Associates, a Republican PR firm, that previously had employed Ken Kersen, the editor-in-chief of the New York Observer, run by Trump's son-in-law. This ad, which went out under the banner of Shmuley Botiak's fake charity, the Jewish Values Network, or This World, this was a Trump operation. This was kind of a, you know, dark ops by Donald Trump to paint Hillary Clinton as anti-Israel just days before the AIPAC conference, the summit of the major pro-Israel lobbying organization in Washington. So it featured me and my father surrounding Hillary Clinton, kind of whispering in her ear. We were her secret Jewish advisors.
Right.
It was kind of, you know, it had kind of classically anti-Semitic theme of the two Jews with funny names telling her what to think about policy. And it falsely accused me of calling Israelis Judeo-Nazis, which, you know, would have been legally actionable if we were in another country. Mm-hmm. But what this really, I mean, but the origins of the ad started with a crowdfunding campaign. Now, I don't understand why Shmuley tried to crowdfund this ad, but he got very little interest. And the ad went up on GoFundMe, which is a crowdfunding site.
Right.
I contacted GoFundMe and I told them, you know, this is defamatory and it contains several false claims about me that violate your user conditions. So they took down his crowdfunding campaign until he addressed all of the factual errors. And what went back up was basically stripped of all of the teeth because he thereby conceded that the ad was full of lies.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, Shmuley turned to one of the donors that Rob reported on in his expose, probably Sheldon Adelson, who has endorsed Trump. This is the Las Vegas casino billionaire who's contributed more money to the Republican Party than any donor in history, and is very close to Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu is also friendly with Shmuley Botiah. And so Shmuley's kind of acting as the bagman for Adelson and Trump now. And this ad campaign really laid bare how the Trump campaign functions. It's not really a formal campaign. It relies on a series of individuals who have informal roles, and it's very fluid. And Ken Kersen, who helped write the Trump speech at AIPAC,
mm-hmm.
that Trump delivered at AIPAC, along with Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is the de facto press secretary and speechwriter for Trump. This is Giuliani's former speechwriter. Remember, Rudy Giuliani was one of the first Republicans to endorse Trump, and Trump has proffered Giuliani as a kind of advisor on Muslims, on basically how to round the Muslims up.
Right.
So you're seeing all the pieces come together around Shmuley Botiach and the New York Observer. And actually, a little bit of trivia, which has been completely ignored by mainstream media, is that in that famous video of Corey Lewandowski, who's kind of Trump's henchman, grabbing the arm of Breitbart reporter Michelle Fields, which was, you know, falsely described as an assault, Ken Kersen is standing right next to him. He's in Trump's inner circle. He's part of the entourage. And yet he has no formal role on the Trump campaign and is acting as the editor of a newspaper in New York. And at the same time, he's apparently crafting ads to smear me as a Hillary Clinton surrogate. So this is really an amazing story. The media has yet to unpack it, and I think Rob is probably the first reporter to do so.
And Max, I'd like to get your comment on this, because if you read more of Hillary's emails than the ones that were sent from your father, Sid Blumenthal, to Secretary Clinton, you will see, for example, that she was a strong advocate for putting American troops into Syria in 2011 or 2012, and her stated reason was to protect the interests of the state of Israel. And so her record, I think, is over the top in support of the Zionist extremists who run the state of Israel right now. And so it begs the question, why would Trump, through Shmuley Botiach, want to attack Hillary on Israel? And my answer, and I'd like your reaction, is that this is a swift voting exercise, that you attack the candidate on his or her perceived strengths and attempt to bring them down in that manner, as the swift voters did with John Kerry in 2004.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And this is a strategy that the Republican Jewish Coalition, which is funded almost entirely by Sheldon Adelson, has employed in every election since 2000 or 2004, which is to try to paint the Democrat, whoever they are, as anti-Israel in order to corral as much pro-Israel money from these kind of Scrooge McDuck Likudnik billionaires that they can get. They, you know, their fantasy is to peel someone like Chaim Saban away from the Democratic Party. It's not worked. If it's done anything, what it's done is create more space for Hillary Clinton to be vehemently supportive of the Israeli government, which, you know, that's an added benefit because these people genuinely believe in Benjamin Netanyahu and are intimately connected to him and actually enjoy a political relationship with him.
Mm-hmm. Max, let me turn now to Rob Bryan. Rob, do you have a comment on these issues we've just mentioned, the attacks on Clinton over Israel, which is clearly one of her strengths?
I actually reported on the AIPAC conference for Alternet earlier, and I quoted something when I was discussing, the speeches that both Trump and Hillary gave at AIPAC. And there's an old article in New Left Review where Edward Said writes that no one exemplifies the sway of AIPAC better than Hillary Clinton. And I think that's still pretty much true today. I mean, she's easily just as pro-Israel as anybody. So, I think it's, your description of it is pretty accurate. It was just this kind of way to demonize her without any real support or backing from reality, which is that, you know, she's always been super pro-Israel. She's always defended Israel pretty much no matter what. And if you look at the debate with Bernie Sanders recently, you know, she refused to even acknowledge that Protective Edge was disproportionate, much less a war crime. So I think, you know, the facts kind of speak for themselves.
And do you see this as an effort to keep her in line, to get her to go even deeper into public support for Israel? Or is it just kind of a brushback intended to damage her and help Trump?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of comparisons, and I make a few of them in the article, to be made between Shmuley and Trump. But, you know, one thing that is kind of a strength and a weakness for both of them, and it's typical of you know, con men, I guess, in general, or grifters, is, you know, it's people that kind of are very comfortable talking off the top of their head or off the cuff. And, you know, it's the reason why they were both on reality shows. It's the reason why they can both give these speeches that obviously were not prepared, where they're just kind of riffing. And I think they just sort of say whatever. They sort of make stuff up and see what sticks. And some of it does, some of it doesn't. Some of it is semi-true, some of it is provably false, and they're just kind of attacking her however they can.
And Max Blumenthal, to what extent do you see this as either directly or indirectly managed by the Netanyahu government in Israel, its ambassador Dermer, its new UN envoy Danny Dannon? To what extent do you see this as directly coordinated with the Israeli government, Max?
You know, when it comes to the Trump campaign, it's hard to know if there's any direct coordination. What I see is a common sensibility that's emerging among all of these forces. And I think that the briefing that was reported on this week by Bloomberg about Trump's briefing with his campaign surrogates, where he overruled them all when they protested demonizing a Mexican-American judge, really tells it all. Trump has instructed his surrogates to call critics racists. And, you know, this is someone who's using racism as a political weapon. That is the strategy that Benjamin Netanyahu has employed. Benjamin Netanyahu hosted Shmuley Botiah in his VIP box when he spoke before Congress and attacked his critics as anti-Semites. We've seen Denny Danon, the UN, the Israeli ambassador to the UN, who is a far-right figure, even well to the right of Netanyahu, host a conference in New York on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, which basically instructed young, mostly Jewish American advocates for Israel on how to demonize their opponents as anti-Semites. And then you saw Shmuley Botiah outside AIPAC. Rob was reporting from inside and reporting on how Trump, despite a planned walkout by some more liberal attendees, actually not only won over the crowd, but turned it into a kind of Coliseum rally. And on the outside, I ran into Shmuley Botiah and his family and confronted him about the lies that he printed about me, or that his, you know, that the Jamestown associates printed about me in his name, right, in the New York Times. And the first thing he does is call me an anti-Semite, and he claims to speak on behalf of the Jews. We're seeing this strategy employed in the UK to destroy the progressive wing of the Labour Party. Recently, Jackie Walker, who's a veteran anti-racism activist, who's actually of African and Jewish descent, who's a black woman, was suspended from the party for supposed anti-Semitism because she referred to slavery as the African Holocaust. So we're seeing this kind of smear strategy, character assassination and character destruction employed across the board. And people like Shmuley Botiah have appointed themselves as kind of champions of the quote-unquote Jewish people in order to attack anti-racists. And what Rob has done, I think that's incredible. It was shown that he's a huckster, and not only a huckster, someone who, you know, fits in naturally with the Trump campaign, but a complete fraud. Shmuley Botiah has been disowned by his rabbinical teachers in the Chabad sect of ultra-Orthodox Judaism. He actually has no synagogue. He has no congregation. He was disowned, and his teacher said that it is forbidden for Orthodox Jews to listen to him speak or read a word that he's written.
And Rob also pointed out that Shmuley tried to claim religious tax exemption for his mansion in New Jersey by claiming that he had set up a synagogue or a temple there.
Exactly. I mean, he tried to get a parsonage tax exemption, and he built the synagogue in his backyard for the sole purpose of getting a tax exemption. So what Rob has shown is that Shmuley, who's aiming to be Trump's top Jewish surrogate, who's definitely a bag man for Trump, you know, character assassination operations, is a complete con artist who pays himself most of the donations he rakes in for his charity. He claims that the full page ad, this is in his 990 forms he files to the IRS, the full page ad he took out about me was part of his charitable mission. And outside of the salary he paid himself, the rest of the money in 2014 that he got for his charity went to an $800,000 gala for Sheldon Adelson, the Republican sugar daddy who's now pledged $100 million to Donald Trump. So this is just a coterie of hucksters and con artists using racism as a weapon and painting their opponents as, in Donald Trump's words, the real racists.
And Max, on May 17th, you published at Alternet a piece that shows that Bill Kristol is now the target of the kind of smear campaigns that he previously aimed at other people. And he is being tagged as a renegade Jew because he's not willing to support Trump for president. This is really bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, it seems bizarre. What I pointed out was that, you know, David Horowitz, the ultra right wing neoconservative who's a Trump supporter, when he called Bill Kristol a renegade Jew at Breitbart, I think a lot of the mainstream media missed the plot. And for them, it was that Trump is mainstreaming anti-Semitism. But in fact, it was Bill Kristol who mainstreamed these attacks by painting Jews like me and Rob as renegades through the Weekly Standard and through the Free Beacon tabloid that his son-in-law, Matthew Continetti, who's not even Jewish, runs. So basically, he was just getting a taste of his own medicine. But what's incredible about Kristol and the Never Trump movement is it's basically a collection of neoconservatives who think that everything's just fine in Netanyahu's Israel, but that Trump's America is a fascist dystopia. And the reason that they hate Trump so much, it actually isn't political. It's because they've been cut out of consulting, the kind of consulting jobs and campaign jobs that they usually get whenever a Republican runs. Whenever a Republican runs, they call on Bill Kristol and his team to tell them what their foreign policy position should be. That's what the McCain campaign essentially did. It's what the Romney campaign essentially did. Now they're cut out, and you've got these lowbrow hucksters like Shmuley Bhotia and Jared Kushner, who's basically a real estate developer, and Ken Kersen, who's like this two-bit crony posing as a journalist. Those are the guys that Trump's listening to. That's what infuriates Bill Kristol. It's the hubris and arrogance of Trump to not listen to the neocons and pay them.
And one of the examples, Max, that you include in your article is intriguing to me because you argue or you lay out facts that build the case that Alan Dershowitz was central in the public assassination of Judge Goldstone, who was commissioned, Richard Goldstone, the South African judge, who led the UN investigation into war crimes in Israel in 2008 when they attacked Gaza. And you link Sheldon Adelson to Dershowitz. Dershowitz has worked for Adelson. And you see him as a central player in the effort that brushbacked Judge Goldstone and got him to essentially repudiate the report that he had authored.
Well, it's well known that Dershowitz led the campaign. Dershowitz, I think, is someone who's condemned Trump. And what Dershowitz did was he called Richard Goldstone a Moser, which is the ultimate designation historically of a renegade Jew. Basically, in shtetl life and going back throughout Jewish history, the term Moser, which is, you know, a Yiddish kind of Yiddish inflection of an original Hebrew term, it basically means snitch, someone who snitches on fellow Jews to the Gentiles. And this really, you know, comes from Jewish ghetto life in Europe, Jewish shtetl life, where Jews were being heavily persecuted by Gentiles. And so snitching often caused Jews a lot of pain and hardship. And the punishment ranges sometimes from execution to cutting off of the tongue to communal castigation. And for Dershowitz to invoke that against Richard Goldstone, who exists within the very tribalistic South African Jewish community, was extremely dangerous. It was incitement. He wound up being excluded from his own grandson's bar mitzvah. His grandson's bar mitzvah was protested, and he was unable to attend thanks to this campaign against him. And he eventually retracted his findings against the wishes of the real authors and researchers of the Goldstone Report because of this campaign to paint him as a renegade Jew as he entered, you know, the twilight of his own life. And that's the kind of behavior we've seen from the kind of things people who are now painting Trump as the real fascist. No one's noted this yet, but I was just browsing through Daniel Pipes, the neocon who was a former Bush administration official. I was browsing through his Twitter account. He called for emulating ISIS slavery tactics against captive ISIS fighters, for enslaving them as punishment for joining ISIS. And this is someone who's called Trump a neo-fascist. So basically what Trump has done is lifted the mask on the whole Republican establishment and showed how they've mainstreamed the tactics that he is now capitalizing on.
And Max and Rob, I'm not sure you're aware of this, but I'm located in Marin County, California, and as we're speaking, it is Election Day here. And a young woman who challenged our sitting Congressman Jared Huffman, her name is Erin Schrode. She's 25 years old, and she's Jewish. And as a result of her information being picked up by the Daily Stormer website, they published her email, her personal phone number, and she has received virulent messages. And I'll just acknowledge that this is really gross as I read it. Somebody wrote in an email to her, "Everyone knows it's time for America's first evil, retarded, teen cunt Congress kike." Another wrote, "Fire up the oven." Another said, "All would laugh with glee as they gang raped her and then bashed her bagel eating brains in." So this is a byproduct of the smear campaigns that start off with Zionists, but then filtered through the hateful Trump prism, we wind up with these kind of neo-Nazis who feel free to attack a Jewish woman who, to my knowledge, hasn't offended them in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, you just, in terms of the vilification of anti-Zionists in general, you mean?
Well, and that Trump has unleashed hate speech, and this is actually, you know, on the flip side of his support group in the Jewish community.
Right. Well, I mean, he sort of has created these alliances that seem bizarre but actually make a perverse sort of sense. I mean, on the one hand, he is, almost actively courted the white nationalists in his base, which, you know, a lot has been written about how neo-Nazis, white nationalists, white supremacists make up a big part of his base because they relate to that sort of racist, white supremacist, nativist rhetoric. On the other hand, he has, the people who are at the AIPAC conference, people who are well-to-do, coastal elites, people who, occupy powerful positions in the media. And so he's kind of, trying to reconcile Zionism with white supremacy, which isn't that hard because there is so much white supremacy inherent in Zionism already. And he's sort of, writing that line. But of course, you know, this exposes the fact that, again, anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are two completely different things. And, you know, he has a base that is both virulently anti-Semitic, many of them, and also a lot of Zionists as well. And he's managed to kind of ride that line.
Well, it is the racism that is the common thread. The targets are different, but, you know, the fundamental there is that racism is okay. And as Max referred to in Trump's attacks on Judge Curiel, we see that he is unapologetic and continues to double down even when his so-called advisors try to, caution him otherwise. And next, I want to ask you both about the remarkable move by Governor Cuomo in New York this past week. On Sunday, he marched in a pro-Israel parade, and then he held a photo op where he signed an executive order imposing a plan to punish people who support boycott, divestment, and sanction. This is after the legislature in Albany failed to pass a bill. They spent 5 months working it over. We have a similar bill in California that fortunately was deeply amended and watered down and essentially is just a toothless resolution now. But what's interesting about the California bill is that the amended language requires the Attorney General to review its constitutionality. And the move by Governor Cuomo in this executive order has been immediately challenged on a constitutional basis and has been labeled a new kind of McCarthyism. Max, do you have a comment about Governor Cuomo?
Well, we saw an amazing act of authoritarianism by Governor Cuomo and an attack on free speech, where he pledged to establish a McCarthyite blacklist of companies that he and his staff decide are involved in boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which could really mean anything if companies refuse to do business in the occupied territories, for example, which is, you know, technically an illegal act under international law. They could be placed on this blacklist. It's an unusual act by Governor Cuomo, but it fits within the emerging strategy of the pro-Israel lobby. Governor Cuomo is the co-chair of the American Jewish Committee's campaign against the BDS movement. Governor Cuomo marched in the Israel Day Parade, which is a festival of anti-Palestinian incitement in the middle of New York City, just moments after he signed this bill. And this was obviously a tip of the hat by Governor 1% to his millionaire donors. Governor Cuomo has never threatened corporations, to my knowledge, ever in his entire tenure, until it was time to defend apartheid and appeal to his millionaire pro-Israel donors. So this really shows the kind of leadership that Cuomo's put on display across the board, not just on the Israel-Palestine issue. But as you mentioned, there is an unconstitutional aspect to it. It's going to face legal challenges. And at the same time, Senator Chuck Schumer, another close friend of Wall Street who's very unfamiliar to the concept of regulating corporations, has vowed to make this a federal law, to use what Cuomo's executive order and the kind of apparatus that he's going to put in place to take that to the federal level and to introduce this legislation in the Senate. Schumer delivered a speech to Agudat Israel, which is a kind of umbrella group of Orthodox Jewish organizations, and he described BDS activists and the BDS movement, which is a global human rights movement, as anti-Semites. And so this is very similar to the language we've heard from Trump describing anti-racists as the real racists. We're seeing a bipartisan incitement against Palestinians, anti-racists, and human rights activists. And it's kind of a disturbing time to live in. But at the same time, I think it's encouraging because it shows that the pro-Israel movement is relying entirely on support from the 1%, from a very undemocratic authority. And it can't really cultivate support among among the masses that came out to support Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. And the other question I have related to these attacks on the BDS movement, which I see as purely free speech rights of those who choose to steer their dollars and their views in a certain direction, is that the State of Israel has budgeted $26 million this year alone to attack the BDS movement. And Max, you referred to Danny Dannon and the conference that he held in New York in recent days. So to what extent is the domestic attack on BDS, again, coordinated or directed from Tel Aviv?
I don't know where that money's going. But we just, I mean, Sarah Lazar at our Gray Zone project
at Alternet reported on that $26 million, and they have pledged that money for a campaign of cyber attacks, including character assassination of BDS advocates, specifically targeting Muslim American college students and Arab American college students. So a foreign entity is actually targeting American students and American citizens based on their ethnicity. They made that clear in announcing this initiative in Jerusalem. And at the same time, Sarah reported last week that the websites of the BDS movement, of organizations that are advancing BDS, are facing sophisticated denial of service attacks, and that a report has shown that these are attacks being directed from abroad and that are probably part of this initiative. So we're seeing heightened attacks on the BDS movement, and they have not stopped its momentum one bit. The only thing that would stop the momentum of this movement is if Israel actually changed its policies, right, and became the democracy that it claims to be.
And Rob Bryan, do you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, I wanted to add, a couple things. I actually was covering an event recently where I met someone who was a Jewish Agency Israel fellow to Hillel at a college campus. Actually, there were a couple people. And Jewish Agency isn't, directly funded by the Israeli government, but certainly, is instrumental in Israel's founding. And there is a concentrated effort both among NGOs, the Israeli government, et cetera, to fight BDS, particularly on college campuses. This is something I saw at AIPAC as well. Open discussion of basically using alumni networks to, threaten to cut donations if groups like SJP are allowed to promote BDS on campus. So one of the really chilling things about, something like the decision that Cuomo made recently is, wondering how it is going to affect the SUNY, CUNY, all of these state-sponsored educational institutions, and how, the BDS movement is going to combat, people who frankly have a lot more money than they do and, still wield a fair amount of influence. So I think that it really is, like Max said, a matter of just fighting until Israel becomes a democracy it pretends to be. I mean, that's a good way of putting it, and I'm not holding my breath, but obviously that's the goal.
Right. Gentlemen, my last question relates to the recent announcement by Netanyahu that he was sacking the defense minister Yaalon and replacing him with the ultranationalist Avigdor Lieberman. And this is against the backdrop of the episode in March where an Israeli medic at a scene picked up a gun and shot and killed at point-blank range a Palestinian who was suspected of a knife attack on an Israeli. The Palestinian was wounded on the ground, unarmed, and Yaalon was trying him for manslaughter, which to me is weak, but it's a step in the right direction. And Lieberman and Netanyahu openly interfered in the process, with Lieberman appearing at the trial and Netanyahu calling the family to comfort them, the family of the medic, not of the victim. When Netanyahu announced or swore in Lieberman, he said, and I'm just trying to process this, that this appointment would broaden his government and improve the prospects for peace. Let me get your comments first, Rob.
One of the sort of ridiculous things about this whole event is the fact that Yaalon was trying to sort of paint himself after the fact as someone who was horrified by the violence of the Israeli government, when in fact, if you look at his own record, he's described the Palestinian threat as a cancer. He said some pretty horrible things himself. Obviously, Avigdor Lieberman, represents the far right. He's said that Palestinians should be beheaded with an axe. He said that he wants them to drown in the Dead Sea. He's really just this kind of awful, you know, bully, and it's a sign of the rightward drift in Israeli politics that he's being elected. But again, you know, his predecessor wasn't so great either. So it's not, it's important not to exaggerate the difference between the two. I think, you know, the, as far as the execution style killing that you you mentioned, it would have been nice if that could have galvanized the Israeli public against the IDF. I think if anything, hopefully it'll galvanize the international public against the sort of insanely militaristic, racist climate in Israel right now. But the truth is, you know, there was a huge rally in support of that soldier. There's a huge number of Israelis that actually think the soldier in question is being unfairly punished. And that's also obviously a very obvious sign.
A majority of Israelis, according to all recent polling, support Elor Azaria's total exoneration and oppose him being tried for manslaughter. And that's really where Lieberman comes in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wrote about Lieberman extensively in my book, Goliath, because I saw him as such a pivotal player in Israeli politics. And I was attacked for doing so by, you know, pathetic liberal Zionists who don't deserve mention and, you know, will never apologize. But, and it's unfortunate that I've been vindicated so strongly. But what I wrote was, you know, I started with the history of Soviet Jews basically being dumped in Israel by the Jewish Agency. 1.3 million emigrated to Israel. Many of them had no idea where they were going and were being enticed with benefits. Didn't really have Zionist politics, let alone Jewish religion. And they were treated horribly when they came to Israel. They basically wanted benefits. They wanted civil marriage. And to get benefits, you had to go in the army. When you go in the army and you're Russian or you're Mizrahi or a Jew of Arab descent, you go into the border patrol. You go into the units that are the real grunts of the army that are involved in the dirtiest aspects of occupation enforcement. You are probably from a family like Elor Azaria, who's a lower class or a working class Mizrahi Jew who executed this immobilized Palestinian in a really disgusting scene in Hebron, which is the ultimate theater of apartheid. So Lieberman organizes these 1.3 million, and they've all been brought in to outpace the Palestinian supposed demographic threat. And Lieberman organizes them into a political bloc. He calls it Yisrael Beiteinu. And each Israeli election, starting in 1996, after he emerges from Netanyahu's Likud party as Netanyahu's Russian handler and starts this new party, each election he wins two seats to the point where his party becomes a force to reckon with. Now, this incident occurs where Azaria kills this Palestinian on camera, blows his brains out in cooperation with Israeli paramedics. It's filmed. The video goes viral. Netanyahu doesn't know what to do. His defense minister, Moshe Yaalon, who really represents the intelligence, the military intelligence establishment, is upset because he wants to continue enforcing occupation, but through a series of ad hoc laws, and he wants to keep Israel's international image sort of manageable. That's the way it's been. Meanwhile, the deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army, Yair Golan, compares Israeli society to 1930s Germany on Holocaust Remembrance Day. So all hell is breaking loose. Netanyahu has to somehow find a way to hold on to his very narrow right-wing governing coalition, the most right-wing coalition in Israeli history, and manage the generals, who don't really respect him that much because he didn't do too much in the army. The best way to do it is replace Yaalon altogether, who is speaking for the generals, and bring in Avigdor Lieberman, someone who repaired tanks in the army, who couldn't care less about the generals, and whose own deputy, Sharon Gal, was the spokesman for Elor Azaria, the grunt soldier who executed this young Palestinian man in Hebron. So Lieberman, what Lieberman represents is the Israeli street coming into power. The generals are being neutered. Religious nationalists who represent another part of Netanyahu's coalition get more power now. And Lieberman also represents a weakening of the army, which might actually be a good thing because he doesn't have the same. It was Yaalon who presided over the assault on the Gaza Strip in 2014 that left 551 children dead, who got so much international support to do so. Lieberman could not garner that kind of support from Washington, and he's a godsend for the BDS movement. So there's that, and then there's Lieberman claiming that he supports the two-state solution. That is actually true. Avigdor Lieberman lives in a settlement called Nokdim, but he is not a religious settler, and he has said, I'll move if there's a two-state solution. His two-state solution looks a lot like the Oslo Accords. It gives the Palestinians a series of Bantustans, and it basically prioritizes creating an exclusively Jewish state in Israel, along with the major settlement blocks, getting all of Jerusalem and giving the Palestinians what he calls some cantons. So Lieberman is not a one-stater like Yaalon was, and he just simply wants to do away with the Palestinians. What this means is more pressure on the 20% of the Israeli population that is Palestinian but who are citizens of Israel. That's who Lieberman called for beheading. He called for beheading their political representatives. That's who he called for drowning in the Dead Sea, Israeli citizens who aren't Jews. And that's really the most disturbing aspect of Lieberman that's been completely left out of all the discussions about him, is that he does favor a two-state solution, but what he does is he lifts the mask on how racist the two-state solution really is. It's about total ethnic separation.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Well, Max and Rob, I want to thank you for joining me today. I learned quite a bit, not only about Shmuley Boteish, but also about the current situation in Israel. I'm grateful for the coverage that you provide in the Gray Zone at alternet.org, and I'll keep reading you. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview podcast. I always welcome your comments and feedback. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.